Chapter 90. What happened at Hanamanu on the other side of the Isle, and was the large and populous bay of Hanamanu, where the men sought might yet be found. But as the sun was setting by the time the boat came alongside, we got our offshore tacks aboard, and stood away for an offing. About daybreak we wore, and ran in, and by the time the sun was well up, entered the long, narrow channel dividing the islands of La Dominica and St. Christina. On 1H, and was a range of steep green bluffs hundreds of feet high, the white huts of the natives here and there nestling like birds' nests in deep clefts gushing with verdure. Across the water, the land rolled away in bright hillsides, so warm and undulating, that they seemed almost to palpitate in the sun. On we swept, past bluff and grove, wooded glen and valley, and dark ravines lighted up far inland with wild falls of water. A fresh land breeze filled our sails, the embayed waters were gentle as a lake, and every wave broke with a tinkle against our coppered prow. On gaining the end of the channel we rounded a point, and came full upon the bay of Hanamanu. This is the only harbor of any note about the island, though as far as a safe anchorage is concerned it hardly deserves the title. Before we held any communication with the shore, an incident occurred which may convey some further idea of the character of our crew. Having approached as near the land as we could prudently, our headway was stopped, and we awaited the arrival of a canoe which was coming out of the bay. All at once we got into a strong current, which swept us rapidly toward a rocky promontory forming one side of the harbor. The wind had died away, so two boats were at once lowered for the purpose of pulling the ship's head round. Before this could be done, the eddies were whirling upon all sides, and the rock so near, that it seemed as if one might leap upon it from the masthead. Notwithstanding the speechless fright of the captain, and the hoarse shouts of the unappalled Genin, the men handled the ropes as deliberately as possible, some of them chuckling at the prospect of going ashore, and others so eager for the vessel to strike, that they could hardly contain themselves. Unexpectedly a counter-current befriended us, and assisted by the boats we were soon out of danger. What a disappointment for our crew! All their little plans for swimming ashore from the wreck, and having a fine time of it for the rest of their days, thus cruelly nipped in the bud. Soon after, the canoe came alongside. In it were 8 or 10 natives, comely, vivacious-looking youths, all gesture and exclamation, the red feathers in their headbands perpetually nodding. With them also came a stranger, a renegade from Christendom and humanity, a white man, in the South Sea girdle, and tattooed in the face. A broad blue band stretched across his face from ear to ear, and on his forehead, was the taper figure of a blue shark, nothing but fins from head to tail. Some of us gazed upon this man with a feeling akin to horror, no ways abated when informed that he had voluntarily submitted to this embellishment of his countenance. What an impress! Far worse than Cain's, his was perhaps a wrinkle, or a freckle, which some of our modern cosmetics might have effaced. But the blue shark was a mark indelible, which all the waters of Abana and Farper, rivers of Damascus, could never wash out. He was an Englishman, Lem Hardy he called himself, who had deserted from a trading brig touching at the island for wood and water some 10 years previous. He had gone ashore as a sovereign power armed with a musket and a bag of ammunition, and ready if need were, to prosecute war on his own account. The country was divided by the hostile kings of several large valleys. With one of them, from whom he first received overtures, he formed an alliance, and became what he now was, the military leader of the tribe, and war god of the entire island. His campaigns beat Napoleon's. In one night attack, his invincible musket, backed by the light infantry of spears and javelins, vanquished 2 clans, and the next morning brought all the others to the feet of his royal ally. Nor was the rise of his domestic fortunes at all behind the Corsicans. 3 days after landing, the exquisitely tattooed hand of a princess was his, receiving along with the damsel as her portion, 1,000 fathoms of fine tappa, 50 double braided mats of split grass, 400 hogs, 10 houses in different parts of her native valley, and the sacred protection of an express edict of the taboo, declaring his person inviolable forever. Now, this man was settled for life, perfectly satisfied with his circumstances, and feeling no desire to return to his friends. Friends, indeed, he had none. He told me his history. Thrown upon the world a foundling, his paternal origin was as much a mystery to him as the genealogy of Aden, and, scorned by everybody, he fled the parish workhouse when a boy, and launched upon the sea. He had followed it for several years, a dog before the mast, and now he had thrown it up forever. And for the most part, it is just this sort of men, so many of whom are found among sailors uncared for by a single soul, without ties, reckless, and impatient of the restraints of civilization, who are occasionally found quite at home upon the savage islands of the Pacific. And, glancing at their hard lot in their own country, what marvel at their choice. According to the renegado, there was no other white man on the island, and as the captain could have no reason to suppose that Hardy intended to deceive us, he concluded that the Frenchmen were in some way or other mistaken in what they had told us. However, when our errand was made known to the rest of our visitors, one of them, a fine, stalwart fellow, his face all eyes and expression, volunteered for a cruise. All the wages he asked was a red shirt, a pair of trousers, and a hat, which were to be put on there and then, besides a plug of tobacco and a pipe. The bargain was struck directly, but Wyman too afterward came in with a codicil, to the effect that a friend of his, who had come along with him, should be given 10 whole sea biscuits, without crack or flaw, 20 perfectly new, and symmetrically straight nails, and 1 jackknife. This being agreed to, the articles were at once handed over, the native receiving them with great avidity, and in the absence of clothing, using his mouth as a pocket, to put the nails in. Two of them, however, were first made to take the place of a pair of ear ornaments, curiously fashioned out of bits of whitened wood. It now began breezing strongly from seaward, and no time was to be lost in getting away from the land. So after an affecting rubbing of noses between our new shipmate and his countrymen, we sailed away with him. To our surprise, the farewell shouts from the canoe, as we dashed along under bellied royals, were heard unmoved by our islander, but it was not long thus. That very evening, when the dark blue of his native hills sunk in the horizon, the poor savage leaned over the bulwarks, dropped his head upon his chest, and gave way to irrepressible emotions. The ship was plunging hard, and Wyman too, sad to tell, in addition to his other pangs, was terribly seasick. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.